on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. I'm back with you again this evening with lots of health tips and hints, things to make you feel better in these somewhat challenging times. Starting off with the usual news roundup, then going on to some more subjects a little bit more in depth. So first of all, what's been in the news? Now, eating plenty of fatty fish such as salmon and tuna can help improve the lung function of children with asthma. Children can see a big improvement in their breathing within 6 months of eating fish twice a week, that would be too much, wouldn't it? That's according to researchers at La Trobe University in Australia. Now, the findings add to other studies that demonstrate how asthma can be successfully treated almost exclusively with a healthy diet. And the researchers tested the diet on a group of 64 children who had mild asthma, half of whom ate at least 150 grams of fatty fish twice a week, while the rest instead ate their normal diet. By the end of the six-month trial, the children on the high fish diet had reduced bronchial inflammation by 14 units. Now, a 10-unit reduction is considered significant. The fish is rich in omega-3 fatty acids, and these have anti-inflammatory effects that reduce asthma symptoms, the researchers said. And apparently the fats from coconut oil could be a more effective insect repellent than the usual sprays, etc., that we are using, which are often considered the only serious choice that can provide protection against malaria-carrying mosquitoes in tropical regions. The coconut fats provide the same level of protections, apparently, and their effects last longer, say researchers from the University of Nebraska. So, usual insect sprays come with health risks, especially for infants and pregnant women as well. And it also provides just 10 hours of protection against mosquitoes. But the coconut oil derivative can provide protection for up to 2 weeks, the researchers discovered. And the fatty acids in the oil also provide protection against other blood-sucking insects, such as flies, ticks and bedbugs. Now, the researchers created a concoction of coconut fatty acids mixed with water and starch that they tested against the regular repellents. And the compound protected against biting flies and bedbugs for 2 weeks and against ticks for 1 week. It was also used on cattle and it protected them against biting flies for 96 hours over 4 days during a very hot summer. The researchers say it's the longest protection provided by a natural repellent product. Now, I wonder whether that works the same for, you know, just eating coconut or using coconut fats. You know, there are lots of kind of coconut mixtures these days, aren't there? Very coconut body lotion, etc. So I wonder if that works in exactly the same way. It'd be really good if it did. There's obviously something to this coconut, isn't there? And you really are what you eat, as the discovery of the microbiome, which is the millions and trillions of bacteria in the gut, testifies. An unhealthy microbiome can lead to poor health, but this can be reversed quickly, a unique research project has discovered. The microbiome changes as our diet alters during our lifetime, from consuming breast milk to eating soft foods and then solids, and finally vegetables and meats. But eating a poor diet creates a poorly functioning microbiome, which affects the way our immune system deals with viruses and bugs. The good news is that we can change our microbiome by improving our diet. That's according to researchers from Stanford University School of Medicine. That's what they discovered when they researched 4 communities living in the Himalayas, the Raut and Raji communities. They've farmed for the past 40 years and the Tharu for 300 years, while the Chipang are still hunter-gatherers. The gut microbiomes of each community differed, but those of the Raut and Raji communities were most similar. Human microbiomes may have changed gradually as human lifestyle changed, and these changes can happen within a human's lifetime. The discovery echoes similar findings by earlier studies, which noted that the microbiomes of indigenous populations in Africa and South America differed from those in industrialized Western countries. It also throws into question what it is that makes us tick. The standard model has it that we're governed by the genetic coding of our DNA, but these new discoveries suggest that we are more microbial and changeable over very short time periods. So within our lifetimes, we can change our gut microbiome, can't we? What's happening in our bodies? And apparently zinc deficiency could be one of the causes of autism. If so, the mineral may play a key role in preventing and treating the condition. That's according to researchers. The mineral is essential for forming and developing synapses in the brain when the baby is in the womb, and so giving women zinc supplements when they're pregnant could be one antidote to the epidemic. That's according to researchers at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Young children with autism could also take supplements which could possibly reverse the condition. Zinc works by binding two proteins that are essential for the formation and development of synapses, which in turn allow neurons to communicate. A lack of zinc during early development might contribute to autism through impaired synaptic maturation and neuronal circuit formation. That's according to the researchers, and they say that the jury's still out as to whether zinc deficiency is directly linked to autism, mainly because there haven't been any controlled studies on the use of zinc supplements, either to prevent autism in pregnant women or to treat autism in children who have been diagnosed. They caution that too much zinc reduces the amount of copper the body can absorb, which can lead to anemia and bone weakening, and it's also possible that the deficiency could be the result of a poorly functioning gut that doesn't absorb zinc properly. So interesting, isn't it, this research finding out different things? But certainly I would advocate taking supplements, as a being a supplement taker myself. I think they are good for you. Is obviously, again, everything in moderation. I'm not sure that you can literally overdo supplements, because I think your body will just kind of your body won't process them. You'll just naturally eliminate them. If you're taking too many, it's a bit like vitamin C, isn't it? Your body will only take in as much as it needs, and the rest of it is naturally eliminated. And another black mark for obesity, I think, it's been linked to depression. Is obviously a bit of an enigmatic problem anyway, but researchers say they have uncovered the strongest evidence yet that obesity is one trigger of depression. It's the psychological impact of being overweight that's causing the depression rather than any psychological problems associated with obesity. That's according to researchers on the University of South Australia. And it seems to affect women more than men, say the researchers, who compared the medical and genetic data of around 48,000 people with depression against those of 290,000 controls who weren't depressed. Genes that were associated with depression were also linked to obesity and a high BMI. This suggests that being overweight causes depression, particularly in women. And paradoxically, the researchers saw similar links in men who were very thin, a group that's also more prone to depression than people of normal weight. That's interesting, isn't it? So our weight can be linked to our emotional state. I guess when you think about it like that, that's not surprising, is it? And obviously obesity has been linked to having a weaker immune system as well. It's been seen recently with COVID and the current government advice as well. And cancer patients apparently can live longer or even reverse their condition if their vagus nerve is stimulated, which can be done through meditation, yoga and practicing compassion and gratitude, a new study has concluded. Survival times are four times greater in people with higher vagus activity, and the cancer's progress is slowed, especially in the later stages of the disease. The vagus nerve, which runs from the brainstem through the neck and thorax and ends in the abdomen, lowers our heart rate and controls food digestion. And it's involved in three major biological processes linked to cancer: oxidative stress or free radical production, inflammation and stress. And researchers at Vrije University in Brussels took another look at 12 studies involving nearly 2,000 cancer patients that had monitored heart rate variability, which is an indicator of vagus nerve activity. They discovered that the cancer's progress was slower in those whose vagus nerve activity was higher, and this was the case for all types of cancer. The effect of vagus activity was more noticeable in those whose cancers were more advanced or had spread to other organs.
Now, there are four proven ways to stimulate vagus nerve activity: exercise, meditation, yoga and compassion. Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill have shown that compassion activates the vagus nerve, and similar effects have been seen in those who practice the Buddhist loving kindness meditation. So good news once again for meditation, and obviously I can't recommend meditation highly enough. It should be part of everybody's daily routine, even if it's just for a couple of minutes. The results really are amazing. They're fantastic. Right, we're going to take a little break now, and after the break I'll be back with more news. And how much are you drinking now since the lockdown? Has it affected your drinking habits or not? I think for many of us it has. So stay tuned for more right after this.
Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And yes, we're talking about drinking, alcohol consumption during the lockdown. Is it a curse or a cure? Now, obviously having a drink is a great reputation for helping or harming our health. And the scientific advice behind this, doctor's advice, changes so frequently that we don't really know whether we're coming or going with it. Now, positive research has
you know, said that it can be good for you, and then next week you hear people saying that actually alcohol is bad for you. Now, a major new US study of midlifers says drinking in moderation may be beneficial for our brains, helping to protect against dementia in old age. So researchers in the University of Georgia say that they've identified what they call a U-shaped relationship between alcohol and brain health. So maybe this is some good news again for alcohol then. Now, consuming a little, which is 8 units spread over a week for women and 15 for men, may slow mental decline and preserve brain power. Exceeding this amount can damage cognitive function. Now, it comes as a survey published recently that showed 4 in 10 UK households are drinking more than before because of lockdown. Now, experts fear a surge in alcohol-related ill health and liver disease too. So to give you an idea of how consumption adds up, a pint of normal strength beer has 2.3 units of alcohol, the same as a 175ml glass of wine, while a small single measure of spirits counts as 1 unit. Now, the US investigators monitored nearly 20,000 men and women in their 50s, 60s and 70s for about 10 years, regularly assessing their ability to think, reason, remember, solve problems, make decisions and pay attention. And they reported that people who regularly had up to 2 drinks a day were on average a third less likely than teetotalers to develop decreased cognitive function that could lead to dementia. Even those who drank a smaller amount of alcohol each week could benefit, their results suggest. But why? So the study says that the mechanisms underlying the beneficial association of low to moderate alcohol consumption with cognitive function are unclear. Oh no, they still haven't found the answer then. Now, previous studies have reported that low to moderate drinking is statistically associated with better heart health compared with being teetotal or drinking heavily. Other researchers have found that any level of drinking raises your risk of high blood pressure and stroke. Now, perhaps alcohol's role in cognitive function may be a balance of its beneficial and harmful effects on the cardiovascular system. As in life, everything is about balance, isn't it? Now, this relationship has been seen before. In the BMJ in 2018, an analysis of the health records of more than 9,000 civil servants working in London reported that in midlife, moderate drinkers had a lower risk of developing dementia than colleagues who were teetotal or drank more than 14 units a week. Now, University College London have said that consuming alcohol moderately may stimulate anti-inflammatory systems in the brain that preserve cells' longevity. And it may also protect against common problems that afflict ageing brains, including diminished blood flow caused by failing vessels, a build-up of inflammatory toxins, and the formation of plaques that are believed to cause Alzheimer's. As some plant-derived components of alcoholic drinks may also help, the antioxidant effect of polyphenols, such as resveratrol, which are abundant in red wine, has been proposed to be neuroprotective. So, moderation in all things, including alcohol, maybe that's the secret to healthy ageing, or maybe not. Now, the Canadian Institute for Substance Use and Research warns that moderate drinkers are not insulated from harm. They account for significant numbers of alcohol-related medical problems, according to their analysis of hospital statistics. Now, the report was that half of cancer deaths associated with alcohol use in British Columbia in Canada in 2014 occurred among moderate drinkers. And on top of that, about a third of all alcohol-attributable deaths that were experienced by people drinking below the Canadian government's recommended weekly limit of 10 drinks, which is a week for women and 15 for men. 10 drinks a week for women and 15 for men. So they measure in drinks, not units. Now, just to confuse matters, the study did show one benefit of moderate drinking for women only. It appears to be associated with a lower risk of type 2 diabetes, heart attack and stroke. Now, this protective effect did not appear to hold for men who experienced harm at all drinking levels. So the results show that countries such as Canada and the UK should tighten their recommended drinking limits to mirror those in the Netherlands. Now, current UK guidelines say both men and women should not drink more than 14 units spread over a week. The Dutch recommendations, however, say that it's best not to consume alcohol at all. People who do drink should keep it to less than one glass a day. The Dutch, again, measure in glasses, not units. So effectively no more than 4 pints of beer a week. Figures compiled by analyst at Statista show that in 2018, men in England aged 55 to 64 drank on average 15.2 units a week, and women in the same age group consumed on average 11.2 units a week. So when it comes to alcohol use, really less is always better. Now, Australian health officials are already tightening their definition of moderate consumption. Last December, the National Health and Medical Research Council said that having two alcoholic drinks a day is no longer considered safe. It's a tricky one, isn't it? Whether to drink or not to drink. But new guidance should warn adults to have no more than 10 standard drinks a week, or roughly 1.4 drinks a day. And that, the council says, should keep the lifetime risk of dying from alcohol-related disease or injury below 1 in 100. So the jury's out, isn't it, really? I mean, what can you say, really? It's that some studies say that it's good for you and other studies say that it's bad for you. I think the sensible thing is really moderation, isn't it? So more conflicting evidence is that investigators at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore declared that drinking moderately, if we can still call consumption of up to 24 and a half units a week moderate, as the US officially does, that's double what we do, isn't it? Significantly lowers people's risk of developing chronic kidney disease compared with teetotalers. Now, the study of more than 12,500 people in the Journal of Renal Nutrition found that people who consumed between 8 and 14 alcoholic drinks a week had a 29% lower risk of chronic kidney disease compared with teetotalers. Now, even people who consume between 15 and 20 drinks a week had a 23% lower risk, and any more than that, however, and the benefit disappeared. Now, the study leader said the beneficial effect may be explained by the fact that moderate drinking has in some studies been associated with a lower risk of heart disease, a condition that shares similar physiological causes with chronic kidney disease. But another recent study disagrees about the safety of moderate drinking. And that was published last December by the American Cancer Society. It concluded that light to moderate drinking is associated with a greater risk of developing any type of cancer. Epidemiologists at the University of Tokyo and Harvard T. Chan School of Public Health in the US examined health records from 33 general hospitals in Japan, covering more than 126,000 people. Teetotalers had the lowest risk of being admitted to hospital with cancer, and for moderate drinkers, there was an almost linear association between cancer risk and alcohol consumption. The more they drank, the greater their likelihood of a cancer diagnosis. Now, in particular, the risks related to cancers of the stomach, breast, prostate, esophagus, and colorectum, says the report in the journal Cancer. So, why is it that after years of research, we still have no consistent advice about whether moderate drinking is either beneficial or perilous? It's terrible, isn't it? Do we or don't we? Take your life in your hands with everything, don't you, I suppose? But the problem, says a leading British expert in health risks, is that the dangers and benefits of moderate drinking are so modest that they are very difficult to detect and could equally produce positive or negative results, depending on the way in which studies are conducted. Now, the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication at the University of Cambridge said the effects of low alcohol consumption, that is within the UK government guidelines, are so small that the type of studies that they could do would never be good enough to overcome random statistical noise. In other words, it's hard to detect a genuine difference. Another problem is that when scientists compare moderate drinkers with teetotalers, they're not comparing like with like. The sets of people who practice either behaviour are different, so studies end up highlighting basic demographic differences rather than the health effects of modest drinking. So that's kind of like probably their diets are different, everything's different, you know. So one consistent finding across studies is that people who have never been drinkers tend to have different health outcomes than moderate drinkers. But this does not mean it's alcohol that's causing the difference. There are many reasons why people don't drink, including ethical, religious or health ones. And these mean that we can never compare like with like, even with fancy statistical methods. That's why most of these studies you should approach with a degree of scepticism. So I'm sorry I got you all wired there for some kind of conclusion to this, but there is none. People who comply with UK alcohol consumption guidelines will be within the low risk category for drinking. So that's a good clear message, I guess. It's a waste of time to talk about whether the effects of drinking alcohol below 14 units a week are either beneficial or harmful, because the effects will be so small. So you might sway the tiny risk in your favour just by enjoying a modest tipple to the full. The effects of low to moderate drinking, be they either beneficial or harmful, are so small that they can easily be overwhelmed by the pleasure that people get from it. So moderation in all things. That's the conclusion of all of this, despite all of the research that's gone on. Best we can say is moderation. All right, we'll take a little break now, and after the break, I'll be back again talking about depression and does vitamin D help or hinder? Stay tuned for more after this.
We'll do it all, everything on our don't need anything or anyone. If I lay here, if I just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world? Don't quite know how to say how I feel. Those three words are said too much. They're not enough. If I lay here, if I just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world? Forget what we're told before we get too old. Show me a waste time chasing cars around our heads. If I lay here, if I just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world? Just lay here,
Would you lie with me and just forget the world?
Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And vitamin D. So we've had a lot recently, I think, about vitamin D and its possible good effects on helping with the virus, helping boost our immune systems. And for years, people have been prescribed vitamin D, with doctors claiming that it will protect against depression. But a new study of more than 18,000 adults shows that the supplement doesn't reduce the risk of developing mood disorders. Researchers found men and women taking vitamin D3 tablets did not have fewer depressive symptoms than those given a placebo. The team from Massachusetts General Hospital say the findings suggest that it may be time to cast doubt on other presumed benefits of the vitamin. Now, vitamin D is called the sunshine vitamin because the skin naturally creates it when exposed to sunlight. It's also found in foods such as milk, cheese, egg yolks, tuna and salmon, although often in low amounts, which is why supplements are sometimes needed. Previous research has associated low blood levels of vitamin D with higher risk for depression, a serious mood disorder that causes persistent feelings of sadness and affects the ability to go about daily activities in middle age or old age. Symptoms of depression coupled with poor mental health have been linked to premature deaths from drugs, alcohol and suicide. And while treatment methods have significantly advanced with new drugs and therapies available, many mental health experts say prevention and early intervention are key. Now, the study that was set up called Vital Depth Depression Endpoint Prevention in the Vitamin D and Omega-3 trial. More than 18,000 men and women aged 50 or older with no history or indication of clinical depression were examined. Half the participants received vitamin D3 supplements for 5 years, and the other half received a placebo over the same time. At the end of the study period, the group taking vitamins did not have fewer depressive symptoms than those taking the placebo. There were also no higher significant differences in mood scores between the two groups over the course of 5 years. There was no significant benefit from the supplement for this purpose. It did not prevent depression or improve mood, say the Massachusetts General Hospital researchers. So, what can we conclude from that? Goodness, it's just overthrown everything that we've all got to understand over the past few months about vitamin D. But don't throw it away yet. It could still be doing you some good. So, you know, speak to your doctor about it. And the research team added that people taking the vitamin D supplements for bone and metabolic health should continue to do so. So there's obviously still some goodness in the vitamin D. There must be, mustn't there? They can't be doing nothing. Again, it's so vague, I think, a lot of these things, because they're just basing it on their depression. They maybe need, you know, depression and vitamin D levels. They maybe need to look at other lifestyle things as well, and other things that they're doing within their lives, and combining that with a vitamin D supplement. So there must be some people that benefit and some people that don't. Don't know, just thinking out loud there, really. But did you know people who are pessimistic die earlier than those who don't have overtly negative or positive views? A new study suggests researchers found that those with negative outlooks about the present or future died about 2 years earlier than the average person. However, and rather surprisingly, being particularly optimistic was not found to increase life expectancy. A team from QIMR Berghofer Medical Research Institute in Brisbane in Australia says it believes pessimists likely do not look after themselves as well, resulting in their health declining sooner than the health of others. Previous studies have found an association between optimism and pessimism and certain disease or lack of thereof. However, such research has grouped the two onto one scale rather than separate scales, resulting in people with low scores being classified as optimists. Optimism and pessimism are not direct opposites. Now, the key features of the results is that they use two separate scales to measure pessimism and optimism and their association with all causes of death. Now, the study was published in the journal Nature, and the team looked at a questionnaire of around 3,000 participants aged 50 or older. And the questionnaire was part of the Life Orientation Test, which looked at the health of Australians between 1993 and 95, with follow-up information only available through the end of 2009. Participants were given a score on an optimism-pessimism scale based on how much they agreed or disagreed with optimistic and pessimistic statements. Such statements included, "I'm always optimistic about my future," or "If something can go wrong for me, it will." Now, those who scored higher as pessimists were likely to die 2 years earlier on average than those who did not rate as pessimistic. Pessimists were more likely to die earlier from cardiovascular disease and other causes of death, but not cancer. What's more, mood disorders such as depression did not appear to have an effect on the link between pessimism and mortality, and it's not clear why pessimists die sooner, but it's not believed that disease causes the pessimism or vice versa. People who are pessimistic might be thought to not look after themselves and their health as well. They might think there's no point in following advice about diet and exercise and so on. But there are indications that optimistic and pessimistic attitudes can have effects on brain and blood biochemistry and inflammation perhaps on the arterial wall. And researchers also found that high optimism scores did not correlate with shorter life expectancy or a longer one either. Well, that's just ruled that out then, hasn't it? There was also no statistical significance in optimism or pessimism scores between men and women. Now, for future research, the team plans to focus on whether or not a pessimistic person is more fatalistic or accepting their health issues. So anyway, back to vitamin D. And what does vitamin D actually do? Well, it's a fat-soluble vitamin. It's one of the most essential micronutrients your body needs to perform at its peak. Yeah, but vitamin D deficiency is surprisingly common in the US and in the UK. So why is that? And it does have an impact on your body, there's no doubt. And I would imagine, I don't know, the scientists say that vitamin D supplements don't have any effect on depression, but if you're not feeling good about your body, then that makes you feel depressed. But having more vitamin D surely will make you feel better about your body. But anyway, again, it's one of those vicious circles, isn't it, really? So vitamin D may help the body reduce risk of chronic inflammation. It helps regulate cell growth. It promotes brain development and health, and helps the body absorb calcium, keeping your skeleton stronger for longer. That's according to the National Institutes of Health and the Office of Dietary Supplements. And in terms of overall health, vitamin D is involved in bone health and appears to be helpful for those with depression. You see, this isn't another, opposing view. And being deficient may be linked to a weakened immune system, possibly due to the body's hampered ability to activate the T cells that help fight off foreign invaders. Now, we're also learning that vitamin D deficiency may be linked to more severe cases of COVID-19 and increased mortality from the virus. That's according to Northwestern University scientists. Now, more research obviously is needed, and the study authors suggest that vitamin D deficiency might cause immune system cells called cytokines to drastically overreact, leading to harsher lung damage, more respiratory issues, and possibly death. They believe that adequate sources of vitamin D are necessary to support a strong immune system and prevent it from overcorrecting and potentially harming the body. So the immunity and vitamin D connection might be more simple and definitely more universal than its connection to coronavirus alone. Most people are familiar with vitamin D and how it's associated with bone strength, but that's just the beginning. Vitamin D is basically a messenger that helps facilitate healthy communication between the brain and the body. And that's why vitamin D is vital for immune health, because without a healthy link between the brain and the body, we wouldn't be able to communicate to our immune system that it needs to battle illnesses like viruses and bacteria. Both sunlight and dietary sources of vitamin D can be used by the liver and kidney to make the active form our body needs. So How much vitamin D do we need each day? Adults should aim for about 600 IUs per day, and only a few foods top that amount or come close to making a dent in your vitamin D needs. When exposed to sunlight, your body actually absorbs it and converts it into vitamin D. However, this is with unprotected skin. If you are using sunscreen, you may still need a supplement. And if you live in an area where you don't get sunshine all year round, you are more at risk of vitamin D deficiency. There are multiple factors to consider about how much sunlight we need. Fair-skinned individuals are more efficient at synthesizing vitamin D from the sun than darker-skinned individuals. And the time of day and intensity of the sun's rays, your age, sunscreen application, the season, and how far you live from the equator also impact how much vitamin D your body can take from the sun. Unfortunately, as we age, we tend to have a more difficult time synthesizing vitamin D from sunlight. So for that reason, getting outdoors and consuming foods that contain vitamin D is your best bet to getting your daily dose. So don't discard vitamin D. It is good for you. May not be as helpful with depression as we at first thought, but it certainly does lots of other good things for you. So there we are. We're going to take a little break now. Sorry, mine went a complete blank just then. Obviously need some more vitamin D. We'll take a little break now. And after the break, I'll be back with you talking about dementia. And dementia is a huge problem at the moment in the adult population. And, there must be an answer to that, mustn't there? So we're going to be looking at some of the options that we can work with around that huge problem. Stay tuned for more after this.
You're such a big star to me. You're everything I wanna be. But you're stuck in a hole, and I want you to get out. I don't know what there is to see, but I know it's time for you to leave. We're all just pushing along, trying to figure it out. Out, out, out. All your anticipation pulls you down, when you can have it all. Can have it all. It's not good for your health. I know that you can change, so clear your head and come round. You only have to open your eyes, you might just get a big surprise, and it may feel good. And you might want to smile, smile, smile. Oh, don't you let your demons pull you down, 'cause you can have it all. You can have it all.
Hey, hey, so come on, see the light on your face.
community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. interesting fact. Did you know that today and every day, roughly 190 Brits will die from dementia? That's about 1,350 every week. Numbers are steadily and ominously rising. So it is by far our biggest killer, having overtaken heart disease 5 years ago, as fatalities from heart attacks and strokes continue to decline. Within the next few years, more than 1 million Britons will be living with this degenerative brain condition. It's a statistic made all the more shocking when you consider that the dementia death toll is almost four times the number claimed each week at the moment by the COVID pandemic. So it's, dementia is killing four times as many people as COVID is. We should be doing something about dementia, shouldn't we, really? But despite all these grim figures, there is hope, as the latest medical evidence suggests that whether you develop dementia is not simply down to fate. Although it's incurable, a staggering 40% of cases could be prevented in the first place. That's according to a global report revealed at the Alzheimer's Association International Congress last week. Lifestyle factors such as diet, lack of exercise and even hearing loss are responsible for a huge 340,000 of Britain's 850,000 dementia cases, say the report. The leading scientists behind the new study identified 12 risk factors that make us more likely to develop the disease. And crucially, it's within our power to address each one of them if we want to stay healthy into old age. The risks begin to mount in childhood, the report said, but even making small lifestyle changes into your 70s could have a significant impact. The report represents a huge leap forward in the understanding of the disease. 3 years ago, the same research group became the first to prove how much of dementia is preventable, revealing the role of obesity, smoking, type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure. Hearing loss, if untreated, depression and too little exercise also contribute to an individual's risk, while lack of education and social isolation were also factors flagged by the experts. And now three more avoidable dangers have been added to that list based on new data: traumatic head injury, air pollution and heavy alcohol consumption. Now, the authors from the Lancet's Commission on Dementia, a group of international experts, say the findings should be a wake-up call for us all and urged everyone to take responsibility for their own health. They said around 40% of dementia cases could be prevented or delayed by eliminating these risk factors. So what can we do? Well, making changes to diet and lifestyle has a significant effect, not just on reducing the chances of developing dementia, but also keeping the mind sharper and younger. A recent Swedish study found that being a healthy weight, keeping blood pressure in check and staying fit and active were three key factors found to significantly improve mental performance. More than 500 participants aged 60 to 77 were advised to eat lots of fruit and vegetables, whole grains, fish and low-fat dairy, while exercise plans involve strength training at gym plus group exercises to improve aerobic fitness, such as jogging and aerobics. The researchers followed them for 2 years and found they performed better in mental tests by the end, and having boosted their overall health as well. Similar lifestyle changes were linked to a 37% reduced dementia risk in another trial involving 3,000 volunteers. In fact, just making a change to one area, such as giving up smoking, was found to have a big knock-on effect. Now, it's, you know, it really is something serious that we need to consider, because the problem with dementia is as well, you don't realise that you've got it. And most of the time, it's, you can kind of come and go from this, but you have no recollection. And this is the whole problem with a brain disease. So you won't even know whether you have it. And it's awful for people around you to experience. So do you really want to put your loved ones through that? And I think that's something that we need to consider. It's how awful that is. I mean, the grandparents can forget that they've got a daughter, grandchildren, they can forget your names, forget who you are, have no recognition. It's awful. It is the most awful thing. And it's kind of like you lose that person, but they're still physically there. One of the things as well that can increase dementia apparently is living near a busy road. Obviously the exhaust fumes aren't good for you. It can increase the chance of dementia by 10%. Now, the cost of treating and supporting the dementia population in the UK is £34.7 billion a year, and it's set to nearly treble by 2040. So just imagine if the emotional and economic burden could be lifted significantly. A 1% reduction in dementia cases would mean 8,500 fewer people living with the disease. Eliminating all 12 risk factors, we could save 340,000 from being struck by it. That's 40% of the 850,000 people estimated to have dementia in the UK. So there's still much about dementia risk that science can't explain, but there is a reason for some optimism, and armed with new knowledge, it's never been more possible to alter the course of our lives, our later lives, for the better. So, you know, look at ways to combat heart disease and diabetes, improve your hearing, you know, all sorts of things like that can really improve your odds of not getting dementia or delaying the onset of dementia even. I mentioned hearing, and astonishingly, hearing loss in midlife raises the risk of dementia later on by up to 40%, according to some studies. That makes it the leading preventable cause of dementia, experts say. The Lancet Commission found that a deterioration in hearing between the ages of 45 and 64 should be treated immediately, and that simply wearing a hearing aid could significantly reduce the risk of developing the devastating condition in the first place. Now, in fact, its findings have revealed that if all hearing loss was promptly treated, nearly 1 in 10 dementia cases could be wiped out. Now, there's an enormous opportunity to prevent disease. A lot of research now shows people who correct their hearing loss early have the same risk of dementia as the rest of the population. And it was once thought that hearing loss was simply an early symptom of dementia. Now, it may well contribute to its development. Now, we're starting to see that early signs of preventing it or slowing it down could be straightforward as wearing a hearing aid when hearing loss starts. Scientists are still trying to work out precisely how hearing loss affects the brain and contributes to dementia. Some argue it's a sign of general neurological frailty and that hearing loss could be an early symptom of the disease itself. But increasing evidence points towards hearing loss coming first and that it directly contributes to the development of dementia. One reason for the link is that hearing loss makes sufferers more likely to avoid social interaction, which is in itself a risk factor for dementia because it reduces the amount of brain stimulation a person gets. Isolation can in turn lead to depression, which is another known association with the disease, particularly if it affects people in later life. And conversely, the more social contact an individual has over the age of 50, the less likely they are to develop dementia. So the easiest way to be cognitively stimulated is to be able to hear. It's very challenging to be part of a conversation where you have to respond and notice different people in the group. That really makes a difference to being able to socialise. And one recent study found the worse the hearing loss was, the more likely a person was to suffer poor brain function. But definitive studies have shown that as soon as a hearing aid is worn, decline is slowed, meaning it's never too late to book a hearing test. It's a bit like high blood pressure. We know that even mild problems treated early on significantly reduce risks of heart attacks and stroke. Hearing loss will probably one day be seen as the same. Tackling even a small amount of loss of hearing early on will give benefit in the terms of reducing the risk of dementia. Hearing problems, which affect about 12 million people in the UK, occur as we age due to wear and tear and damage to the sensory cells inside the ear. And this gradually affects our ability to pass sound signals to the brain. And it starts earlier than you might expect. At least 10% of people aged 40 to 69 will already have noticed that their hearing isn't what it once was. And in the over 65s, nearly a third have a significant measurable loss. And one US study found that those who had poorer hearing in midlife, when their brains were scanned nearly 20 years later, they had greater shrinkage in the right temporal lobe, the area of the brain responsible for interpreting sounds and language, as well as being involved in learning and memory. Why the brain shrinks, however, remains unknown. So it could be due to the additional effort of listening and concentrating. And because your brain is working harder to follow a conversation, it has fewer resources left to help you fully understand the situation or to store it as a memory. And this could in turn reduce brain volume in areas which aren't being used as much. And studies have also linked hearing loss to smoking and cardiovascular problems, which are both risk factors for dementia. Smoking damages blood vessels all over the body, including those in the inner ear, and the more you smoke, the worse your hearing. So if you can give up, it will preserve what remains of your hearing, and it seems that there is some recovery too. So scientists are pushing for more evidence to prove that hearing aids protect against dementia, so that policymakers can take more urgent steps to actively promote their use. But just advertising the link between hearing loss and dementia may be enough to persuade people to use them. So let's hope so. So let's hope that there is that is a good link there, and that we can do something about hearing loss and helping dementia in future. I mean, even that small percentage, it's not small percentage, is it? 340,000 out of 850,000 people's health could be improved if we just attended to our hearing. Fabulous. And it also means you'll be able to listen to wonderful programs like this, doesn't it? If you attend to your hearing. Okay, well, anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this week's show. It's been great being with you once again. I hope you've got some useful hints and tips to help you in your life and with your health. So until this time next week, take care of your body and take care of yourself.
Maybe that's the reason I've been acting so cold. If I could escape.